Okay, last week was a little bit confusing in that some of you weren't here anyway, but in both classes we got sort of halfway through the lecture. But I've really framed a new lecture. It will include the stuff we didn't get through last week. The question we're looking at is the question of the text of the Greek New Testament. That is, the Greek contents of the New Testament. And really to give a sort of framework to tonight's lecture, I thought of it as a detective case. And the question we're trying to deal with is, the puzzle is to find the most accurate text of the New Testament. Firstly, though, we begin by looking at the nature of the crime. How badly has the Greek New Testament been distorted? Last week I went to some length to try to show you that the crime is not as serious as some people allege. To hear some people talk about some modern versions of the Bible, you would imagine that to use, say, the NIV is to use a different book, a different Bible altogether to the AV. We dealt with that, not exhaustively, but I gave you a sample there. The passages from Mark's Gospel, a typical portion of Mark's Gospel, with a considerable number of differences between the Greek text used by the NIV translators and the Greek text behind the AV and the Revised Authorized Version. But we saw those figures. Do you remember that 42% of the differences involved no change in translation at all? They were just different Greek words or endings that made absolutely no difference in translation. Another 47% made only the most minor difference in translation. Only 10% of the differences in the text made any noticeable difference at all. And none made any important difference. And though I hope I was cautious to say that that is just a random sample, I hope that it, and I'm sure that it's not an untypical sample. And the conclusion is, I think, valid and inescapable, that though there are many differences between the Greek texts underlying, say, the NIV and the Authorized Version, that the significance of those differences is remarkably small. No doctrine of the Christian faith is affected by the differences. No impact on what we believe. And indeed, most of the differences are completely minor. But now, if you look at diagram one, on the other side, we need to define the problem. What I've done there, I'll do it on the board so I can do it. If that is the original, written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, etc., we don't have this. I mean, we might like to think that we had a series of copies made of the original, which were all on a dead straight line, poetic license there on the drawing. But with every copy made accurately to the other one, with complete agreement between them, so that any copy of the New Testament would be exactly the original. We don't have that. What we do have is like a family tree, I suppose, from the original. I can update the figures from last week. I said last week there were over 3,000 manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, all or part. In fact, the figure is now over 5,000. But no two of those are the same. Differences may be very minor, as little as punctuation marks or spelling mistakes. But in practice, what you have is something like this, as I've drawn it there, with each copy differing slightly, more or less, from the copy, from the thing that it was copied from. And what happened was not this, a line of exact copies, but something like this. Some manuscripts, of course, perhaps wouldn't be copied. Some would have just one copy made from them. Some might have three or four copies made from them. But they would all have some differences from the ones that they were copied from, and some differences from each other. And so it would go on something like that. You know, the original would be copied, say, and one copy was maybe in Jerusalem. Another copy was taken to the church at Antioch. The people in Antioch made a couple of copies there, and maybe one of those copies was taken on to Cyprus and or wherever. But you know, and then they were copied and so on. Something like that is probably what happened. No two copies exactly the same, but some process like that. Now, the point I was making last week is that this parameter, that gap, is comparatively small. Even if you take, the widest apart ones, if you take a copy here and a copy there, the distance between them is comparatively small. There'd be a considerable number of differences there, not so as to affect any doctrine. It isn't that we've got something like this with the original there and copies are way off there and are way off there, getting altogether out of line. The differences are comparatively small. Okay, let's come on then to the second point. How could the crime happen? How was it that no two copies are the same? It's a very interesting thing to study the way that mistakes were made in the copying of ancient manuscripts. Originally, it seems, the earliest copies, or in the ancient world, copies of books were made in professional places called scriptoria, where one man would read, and there would be a group of scribes sitting around, each writing down what he wrote. That way, the scriptoria was a sort of book factory. Later on, manuscripts were copied also by eye. A monk would sit, very often in a monastery, with a copy of the original. Beside him, he would read a line, and then he would write it down. It's the difference between dictation and visual, you know, copying. Now, the errors that arose there were accidental errors, first of all. There were the errors of faulty eyesight. You know, I think we did this last week, didn't we? So those of you who were here last week can keep quiet on this. The Greek of the New Testament was written in capital letters without any gaps between words and so on. Now, sometimes that could cause a mistake. Diane, what does that say?
God is now here.
But Ian, what does it say? Yeah. So it depends, doesn't it? Sometimes there could be confusion there. But interestingly, you had no problem, you know, God, you know, making those two divisions. And surprising, actually, if you wrote English down without any gaps between the words, how most of the time there wouldn't be any problem. But occasionally that could cause error. But there were other confusions, sometimes of letters. Greek scribes had some contractions. One famous place where the error, and I'm not sure still which is the original, which is the error, occurred in this way, is in 1 Timothy 3:16. You know, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, or who was manifested in the flesh? The Greek word for God is theos, and they wrote a capital S like that at that stage. But instead of writing theos for God, which is a common word, the scribes just wrote the first letter and the last letter, theos, and they put a little line over the top like that. Now, that's then the Greek word for God. The Greek word for who is the word hos.
written like that. Now the difference between those two is just those two little tiny strokes of the pen in the middle there, in the middle of the top. Remember that they're writing with reed pens on vellum or parchment, which is not the smoothest, not totally smooth surface. Remember that they're using ink and a pen, so you may well have a few smudges around, you know. And you can well see how a scribe, in even worse light than we've got in this room, could make the mistake between them. Now, that doesn't help us to decide which one is right. That's another question. But you can see how an original that said, say, Theos, could become a copy that said Hos, or vice versa. Right. So there are errors like that, faulty eyesight. Another one where you often get an error, as in copying English writing down, is if you're copying a page of writing by eyesight and you have two lines fairly close together that end in the same word or even more in the same phrase, when you're reading and then copying, there's a great danger that your eye will go back, not to the first one, but to the second one, and that you'll miss out the lines in between. One place where that almost certainly happened is in 1 John chapter 2, verse 23. If you know your authorized version well, you know the AV uses italics for words that are not in the Greek original. Well, there's a whole phrase in italics in the AV. He that has the Father has the Son, and he that has the Son has the Father also. But the AV has that whole second phrase in italics. It put it in because it was found in the Latin Bible. But the Greek manuscripts that the AV translators had did not have that phrase in. They put it in italics because they thought from the Latin that perhaps it ought to be there. But in fact, now we know that many manuscripts that do have that phrase in. But probably the phrase has the Son. He that has the Father has the Son also. He that has the Son has the Father also. Somewhere in that, you know, they missed out a phrase and it got left out. That sort of mistake with I. When things were being copied by hearing, dictation, there's another whole class of error. There are words in Greek as in English that great and great words sometimes sound the same. And they could be, you know, confused in that way. Greek letters have, several words. One instance of that is Romans chapter 5, verse 1, where some versions translate it, being justified by faith, we have peace with God. And others translate it, being justified by faith, let us have peace with God. Now, the difference between those two in Greek, one, we have peace with God, is ekomen, and let us have peace with God is with an omega there, which is another letter for O, which, if you exaggerate the difference, that's a short O, ekomen, that's a long O, ekomen. But by the time of the New Testament, those two O's were pronounced pretty well the same. Ekomen, ekomen. So, you know, you can understand again how the differences between the copies arose. Another thing that troubled... Well, another instance of that, Revelation 1, verse 5. Unto him who has loved us and washed us from sins, or loosed us, freed us from sins. The difference between the Greek word for washed and the Greek word for loosed is just this. I write it in English. It's a difference between OU and U. One is loosant and the other one is loosan, loosanti. Both will be pronounced the same. Indeed, by the time of we're talking about the early centuries AD, a whole lot of Greek letters and diphthongs were pronounced the same. It's a great long list. The letter E, U, I, O, I, U, I, E, I were all pronounced more or less the same. Do you know, we have it in English, don't we? We have this awful sound, independent, "unt," and you know, you're never sure whether it's an E or an A. And now in Greek, you've got those differences. Most of the time, all you get at the end of it, if you get one wrong, is a spelling mistake. But just occasionally, it'll make a difference between the words. So quite a lot of the mistakes, of the differences between the manuscripts, came in because the same word, a word when read out, could be taken two different ways. Then another area where accidents could happen, when under dictation. If I say, you know, if I dictate a thing to you and read out a sentence at a time, there's a danger that if you're not quite paying attention, or you know, if you're tired, you've been doing it all day, remember these were professional scribes, you may only half be listening. You may miss out a word, or you may only half catch what the man says, and when by the time you come to write it out, you may, you know, just have the gist of what he says. When we looked at Mark 8 last week, one of the interesting things that we found, several of the differences were a different word had been used, for instance, for "he said" or "he answered." Instead of "he answered," "he replied" was used. Now, I would suggest that mistakes like that came in when a scribe was listening, and, you know, he remembered the gist of it, but he'd perhaps forgotten carelessly exactly the word that was said, especially a sort of low-profile word like "replied" or "asked." I mean, all the attention is on what Jesus said, but, you know, there's a tendency when you're writing down from memory like that. Even the brief memory of copying. Actually, it would be a very good exercise to do this, you know, to if we had time, for me to read out a whole page of a book and then to see what mistakes we had at the end. I think it would be very instructive. How many mistakes creep in, even with attentive and intelligent people like yourselves? Another thing that happened, again, when we saw it in that Mark 8, oh no, it's in Mark 8, it wasn't on the sheet. Mark 8, verse 13, there's a difference between the two texts. One says, "he again embarked," and another says, "he embarked again." And again, if you're listening to a dictation, it's quite common to get words put in the wrong order. Or even, I guess, if you're copying, and, you know, you read a whole sentence and copy it down at a time, without looking again at the page. Variations of order. There's a tendency too to make similar passages conform. This happens especially in the Gospels, the first three Gospels, where you have accounts of the same incident. Also, it happens quite a lot in Ephesians and Colossians, which, if you know them well, have very similar passages. There are places there where some manuscripts in, say, the text of Colossians have extra words in that are found in Ephesians, but are not normally found in Colossians. And it may well be that somebody in copying it down had in their mind the more familiar passage from Ephesians and put that in. Those are really all accidents. Accidents of ear, eye, you know, thought process, memory. Sometimes, though, changes were made deliberately, but mistakenly. For instance, often when a manuscript was being copied, you know, you'd have the text of the thing there like that. But it was quite common, as we've seen the story of the English Bible, William Tyndale and the Geneva Bible, to write a little note in the margin like that. Now, usually that was done, as it is in our Bibles, in a different print, in a different thing there. But there's a danger that when somebody comes to copy that, again, remember, we're not talking about somebody just copying for 3 minutes, but somebody copying all day, every day, writing away. There's a danger that in a careless moment, they'll copy not only the line, but include that in the text as well. And add what was originally an explanatory note or a little comment in the text. There are cases where that's clearly been done because the you know, something that was obviously a marginal note. You know, someday a scribe, I think, wrote something like, you know, "the manuscript is poor here," meaning that the thing he was copying wasn't very good. And he wrote that in the margin, but the next person came along and copied his manuscript and included that in the text. That's obvious. Not so obvious, but I think quite likely, is 1 John chapter 5, verse 7, the famous thing that's in the authorized version, but in virtually no Greek manuscripts at all. There are three that bear witness in heaven: the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. That's found there in a passage where John is speaking about three that bear witness on earth. And I think the most likely explanation of that, it was originally a sort of thought in the margin, or a little comment that somebody jotted down, and that was then included in the text, not of many, probably only of the Latin versions, the only Greek manuscripts that have that in are very late, and are probably were made deliberately to try to justify the reading. But I think that's probably how it got into the Latin region. Another cause of error was conflation, where either different readings from different manuscripts. Suppose you're copying two manuscripts, and one has there the reading A, and the other one has the reading B. Great temptation when you're writing, you say, well, which one's right? And often the scribe would put A and B there. For instance, Acts chapter 20, Paul speaking to the Ephesian elders. He talked about the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. Some manuscripts are found there which say the church of the Lord, which he purchased with his own blood. One or two manuscripts are found which say the church of God and the Lord, which he purchased with his own blood. I think you can see there what's happening. An interesting instance where we do that ourselves is the story of the rich young ruler. Do you know that? That it's found in three Gospels, but in no Gospel is he called the rich young ruler. In some Gospels, in one of the Gospels it says that he was rich, in one it says he was a ruler, or it says he was young. But nowhere does it say the rich young ruler. But, there's a danger when we come to write a manuscript, if we're only half paying attention, if we're writing down, we might put, this rich young ruler came to Jesus. That's a sort of mental mistake. Sometimes, though, texts were changed for deliberate doctrinal reasons. There's a sensitivity to passages that sound wrong. John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is found in one particular place. There are two different readings. Some books of Pilgrim's Progress, if you pick them up, will read in the story of Pilgrim in Doubting Castle. He took the lock out of the key out of his pocket and put it in the lock, the key of prayer and promise. But the lock went damnable hard. Other copies read, the lock went desperately hard. Now, which is the original there? Because in Bunyan's day, the word damnable did just mean desperate. It wasn't to us it would sound almost like a swear word. And in fact, the first 11 editions of Pilgrim's Progress all had damnable. But by the time you got into the next century, the word has got connotations that sound, a bit unfortunate. So somebody changes it. I think, and that case I just mentioned, the Church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. That's a strong text. It's one of the remarkable statements of the Bible. But when you got into some of the tortuous heresies of the early centuries, wrong views of God and of Christ, some people said, well, look, God doesn't shed his blood. God is a spirit. God's not a person. Therefore, Church of God. And you can see how the reading Church of the Lord came up. They were trying to alter an embarrassing reading. Another one that may well be under that heading are the references in Luke chapter 2 towards the end, verses 41 to 48. There are several references, if you read certainly the RSV, I haven't looked these up in the NIV, to Jesus's parents or to his father. And in other versions, you'll find a reference to Joseph and his mother. Now, obviously, you can see the problem. You can see why people would be worried about a reading that said his father, referring to Joseph, or his parents. In fact, if you go carefully into Jewish law and into the genealogy there in Luke's Gospel, Jesus was the son of Joseph, legally. Joseph was Jesus's legal father. And it's quite valid to use the word father there for Joseph. Certainly, it's hard to see why anybody should change a text that read Joseph and his mother into his parents. I suppose that's possible. It could have been, again, one of these other cases of just sort of half remembering. But it is possible. I think it's much more likely to see that somebody very sensitive to misunderstanding should have changed that into Mary and or his mother and Joseph. Of course, there's a third possibility, and that is that somebody deliberately changed the text there in order to try to prove that Jesus was the physical son of Joseph. You know, so you have to decide between those three possible causes of error. Sometimes, of course, texts were changed for doctrinal reasons. Probably the saying of Jesus in Mark chapter 9, verse 29, has been amended for that reason. This kind come out by nothing but by prayer and fasting. That may well be a reason for there. As I think I mentioned last week, a more blatant one in one manuscript, clearly wrong, Romans 14, verse 17, reflects the same concern of monks and monasteries with asceticism and so on. When a passage that probably wouldn't be very popular with such people, Paul said, "The kingdom of heaven is not meat and drink, but it's righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit." One manuscript reads, "The kingdom of heaven is not meat and drink, but is righteousness, asceticism, peace and joy in the Holy Spirit." And obviously that was a monk who thought that Paul needed putting a bit right. You know, he was going a bit worldly there. And you know, there are such reasons. Now, that's, sorry to repeat some of that from last week. But those, I think, without saying which one was right and which one was wrong, in most cases, we can see that those are the causes of error in copying manuscripts. Right, let's come on to the third section. A crime has been committed in the sense that we don't have the exact copies of the New Testament. What we have is not that straight line with every copy identical, but we've got that sort of branching out tree. We've stressed that the crime is not that serious. The tree is not completely widespread. It's within manageable proportions. We've seen how the crime could have happened, the sort of mistakes that can creep into copying. The wonderful thing I think we can say is that with a book copied by so many people in so many parts of the world, in such a variety of conditions and pressures, especially in those first 250 years, the amazing thing is that the errors are so few. And so, by and large, you know, 90% of the differences in readings in the manuscripts are immediately recognisable as having no relevance whatever to the text. You know, you can see immediately that here's a mistake. It's remarkable that with such a process, such a clear thrust is produced. But just where do we stand? Now, here you have a very graphic diagram, number 2. I'll try quickly and do it on the board because it'll help there to put it together. We say what probably happened is what's found up there in diagram 1 on the right-hand side, the family tree. But of course, what we actually have, as we're trying to answer our question, what is the original text? What is the closest to the original text? We don't actually find that family tree anywhere. What we find, neither do we have all the things that were there. That's probably what happened. You know, the original was copied into those two. If you draw a time scale down here from 100 to 1000 AD. Something like that. What we have, remember we said last week we've got perhaps one or two little papyri from that very early time, a couple more here, The earliest unsealed big manuscripts are from about 350. Then we've got quite a few more there. Perhaps like that. Then, when you get down to 1000 AD, we've got the great mass of cursives. Remember, of those 5,000, or last week we said 3,000 manuscripts, the great majority, over 2,000, are cursives written in that joined up writing, which date from about 800 onwards. Now, if each one of those is a manuscript, we find, if we can roughly date them in their timing, roughly, that's the field. You see that we have comparatively few manuscripts. And of course, remember, there are 5,000 there, not the odd 10 or dozen, whatever, however many I've drawn there. Comparatively few from those early centuries up to about 400 AD. The great mass of manuscripts from 1000 AD onwards. That's the evidence that we actually have. Now, we don't have the lines joining them. I've drawn it like that with the weight of those manuscripts there close together, because it is clear from reading them, you know, looking at them together, that they have more in common with each other. They're closer. It's not that they're identical. They're not all in a straight line, these cursives, but the bulk of the cursives are fairly close to each other. But the great question we've got to ask now is really the puzzle, the detective's task, is to try to turn that into that, to join up these things and to show the way they join up, and especially where the top of the tree is. Now, should we join it up like this and have some, perhaps a couple of secondary ones there, like that, and then those there, and that the original? Is that where they've come from? Or is it that these two come there from a copy, and that there, and that those were both poor copies of this one, and that in fact the original is over here? Is that the way up to the original, or is this the way, or whatever? We've got to try to construct a family tree that leads us back up to the original copy, to the original manuscript, as close as we can. That is the evidence that the scholars have. Some of those, remember, are just tiny portions of the New Testament. Some of them are manuscripts of the whole New Testament. That much is definite. That much is a fact. The detective's job is to try to build from those a family tree that leads back to the original. And really, all the argument in textual criticism, the argument that we introduced last week, people saying the AV is based on a corrupt text and so on, all depends on the way the theory that you construct. The question we've got to answer is, how can these things lead us back to the original? And I've put down three theories. I think it's important that we make it three and not two. Obviously, there are, in many ways, as many theories as there are scholars. But theory one, let's call it the received text view. Now, what this says is, it looks at this great mass of manuscripts around here. They are obviously closely related to each other. They are, in that sense, a family or a type of manuscript. And that is usually called these days the Byzantine text, or the Byzantine group of texts. It's called that because it was the sort of text used by the Greek Orthodox Church with its headquarters in Byzantium. It was the sort of authorized version of that church from fairly early on and right through the Middle Ages. Sometimes it's called the received text, but we're going to have to distinguish that. It's a finer point, in a way a footnote, but an important one. When Erasmus came to publish a Greek Testament in 1514, as we said before, he only had a few manuscripts. In fact, he had about half a dozen. And he drew from, say, like that. In fact, he had one that was a bit out, and he didn't like it. He was wary of it because it differed from the others. But Erasmus used that. And from Erasmus, the Textus Receptus was virtually copied and published by a book publisher in about 1560. In fact, the word Textus Receptus, or the received text, was a publisher's selling gimmick. He said, "This is the text received by all." In fact, there were several texts around. It was sort of blurb on the dust cover, but it became the statement of that text, and that, for various reasons, perhaps partly because it was published in Geneva, I think, became the sort of most commonly used text. But the view is, anyway, the answer to our problem, people say, lies in this. Look, this is the majority text. The great bulk of those 2,000 minuscules, more, are this Byzantine text. They differ from each other a bit, but they're recognisably close together there. Now, obviously, then, the answer lies in going straight up from there. This is the text that was used by the church through the centuries. This is the text that was used at the Reformation. This is the text that has the majority of manuscripts. And when it comes to deciding what is the original, well, we count the manuscripts. And we say the majority must be right. Not necessarily out of a sheer sort of, you know, enjoyment of mathematics, but also saying, well, look, if these other manuscripts are found up here that differ from this text, well, why aren't there lots of copies of those? If these manuscripts were better, why didn't the church copy them? And the answer that upholders of view one would give, well, they weren't copied because they were bad manuscripts. If they differed from this text, it must be because they were wrong. Indeed, some people say that if they differ at all, it's because they were deliberately wrong. That the only differences were because of deliberate mistakes, of deliberate changes. But, you know, the church copied and used this version because the church way back recognized that those others were wrong. The majority must be right because it reflects the wisdom of the church through the ages. I've put those one and two. It leads to two distinct views, and this is a slightly significant point. Some people conclude from that, what we need to do today then is to have a Greek text to translate into English that is based on that Byzantine text. Our business is to look at all the manuscripts available and to decide, you know, now you see there are differences between these. Is that way right or wrong? Where, you know, to what we need to do is to get to the best, the sum total of the Byzantine text. Others say, by the way, Van Bruggen, who's written a little book called The Future of the Bible, he represents that position. And so does Wilbur Pickering, who's got a book on textual criticism. Others say, no, we must stick absolutely with that Textus Receptus, that published edition of the Greek Testament that was published in 1560 and that was used by the translators of the Authorized Version. That is the one that is absolutely right. Now, the only people I know who take that view in publications are the Trinitarian Bible Society. Or some of their adherents. The Trinitarian Bible Society, well, that's another story, the history of the Trinitarian Bible Society. But some people, Terence Brown, who is the secretary of the Trinitarian Bible Society, and some other people involved with it, take the view that we must stick with the Textus Receptus in every detail, even to include 1 John 5, the 1 John 5 verse 7. Do you know the story of that? Erasmus, in the first edition of his Greek New Testament, left out that there are three that bear witness in heaven, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, because he didn't find it in any of these six manuscripts that he translated. It was in the Latin Vulgate, the Latin Bible, but he couldn't find it in any Greek Bible. When Erasmus's Greek Testament was published, he was attacked for all sorts of reasons by the church. But one of the criticisms was that he'd left out an important verse from the Bible. And Erasmus rather foolishly said, if you can produce me one Greek manuscript that's got that in, I'll include it in my text. And lo and behold, somebody came along with a Greek manuscript with it in. And Erasmus put it in the second edition of his Greek Testament, but he made it very clear that he suspected that that Greek manuscript had been produced at that time. And indeed, the only known Greek manuscripts that we have with that text included are after the time of Erasmus. There's one older manuscript which has got that text sort of stuck in at the side in a later handwriting. Experts can date things by the handwriting because its style changed over the centuries. And there are a couple of 16th century manuscripts, in other words, copied after Erasmus published his edition, that have it in. But you see, people like the Trinitarian Bible Society, or Terence Brown anyway, would insist that that is part of the Bible and must be put in. Although it is not in the Byzantine text. There's another verse somewhere in Acts chapter 9 that in Paul's account of his conversion, which is not found in any Greek manuscript, which the Textus Receptus, so-called, has in it. Now, if we followed a Byzantine text, we would leave that out, we would leave 1 John 5 out. But there are those who are really so committed to the Textus Receptus, whatever the majority of manuscripts say, that they insist on those things. Well, I'm not sure. I think it's an indicative point. I mean, I don't agree even with the Byzantine text view, but I can understand that and I can see that. My own suspicion is that attitude, that Textus Receptus at all cost view, reveals that it's really traditionalism that you're dealing with here, rather than an unwillingness to accept any change in it. It's hard. I don't know what rationale there is for including the Acts 9 and the 1 John 5. I've never seen any. And, it does seem to me to be an irrational position. Unless you've got any answer on that. Let's quickly press on. The second view, Westcott and Hort, so named because it was their text that was used by the translators of the Revised Version, they went very keen on two. I should have another one in there. That's the thing. Let's put a couple up there. Two manuscripts that were discovered last century or rediscovered last century. One was called Codex Vaticanus, usually written by the symbol B, and the other one was Codex Sinaiticus, the one found in Mount Sinai, which uses the Hebrew letter, which is usually said like that, Aleph. Codex B and Codex Aleph. They decided, they drew their various charts, they decided that the majority text was the result of somebody round about 400 AD revising the New Testament, doing a sort of new edition of it himself, and drawing from various manuscripts in the past and producing a new sort of authorized version. They suggested that the man called Lucian was responsible for this. We know that he did it for the Old Testament in Greek, but there's no evidence that he did it for the New Testament. But that was their suggestion. And they suggest that he was in particular guilty of that conflation, putting together different readings, the Church of God and of our Lord. Now, he didn't do that particular one, but the rich young ruler thing, putting things together. They therefore said, look, all this majority of manuscripts can be put aside. There are lots of them, it's true, but they're all copies of this sort of revised version done by Lucian. What we now have, they say, are these two great manuscripts which are older than that. And they were done before this revision. They're older and they're better. They decided that more or less those things were in the line from the centre. They're usually now called the Alexandrian text. The sort of, all right, there are minor differences between them, but the sort of, overall, the sort of similarities between them, they're called the Alexandrian family. Westcott and Hort called them the neutral text. In other words, they meant by that it was in the middle. It was the centre. And that more or less exactly, in those manuscripts, we were very, very close to the original of the New Testament. They did that mainly on external grounds, that is, on their theory of how the majority text had come about, and the fact, the history of these things. They said here in Egypt where they were produced, that they go back so early. Therefore, without looking in detail at the individual readings, we're sure that these are as close to the original as you can get. They were the neutral ones. That was Westcott and Hort. The third theory I've put down is the modern textual criticism one. And I think it is important to recognise that the people who produce the text that's behind the NIV and so on are not blind followers of Westcott and Hort. To read a lot of the opposition to that text, you would imagine that they were simply copying Westcott and Hort. The modern ones, yes, all right, they recognise that there are these different families of manuscripts, the Byzantine text, the Alexandrian. There's another one sort of over this side with some representatives that's often called the Western text, called Western because it was found in early manuscripts from Rome and so on. The characteristics of that are that it tends to be rather fuller, especially in Acts. It has lots of sort of extra little bits of information in it in Acts. Modern textual critics try to look at the whole thing, not only this sort of framework. They still, while they think that maybe Lucian didn't sit down and revise the whole thing, they think that there was some sort of process of revision there. After Constantine made Christianity official, it's a tendency for everything to be sort of organized a bit more. And the suggestion is that there was a sort of process of revising. They recognised that there was this Western text, the Alexandrian. There were different traditions in Egypt, in Rome, in Byzantium, and in other parts as well. And they try then to decide between the different readings and each occurrence, you know, John chapter 1, verse 18, two different readings. Well, let's look at them. Let's look which manuscripts have this reading, which manuscripts have that reading. How could one have arisen? You know, is there a case here of bad eyesight or bad hearing? Is there a case of deliberate alteration? If so, which one is likely to be the first? And modern textual criticism gives a lot more weight to that sort of question. Faced with two different readings, the proponents of theory one would say, which one is supported by the majority text? That's right. End of argument. Westcott and Hort would tend to say, which one is supported by the neutral text, by these great things? That must be right. Modern textual critics tend to say, well, all right, which one is supported by Byzantine, which one is supported by Alexandrian neutral texts, which one has the best evidence? Along with the text of the New Testament published in that light, there is a fascinating little book called The Textual Commentary on the Greek New Testament, written by Bruce Metzger. And that deals with the various readings, something like John 1:18. Does it say the only begotten Son or the only begotten God? And Metzger gives you a little comment, little note on that, telling how the committee decided to put, in that case, the only begotten God. He tells you what factors affected their decision. He also gives an indication as to how firm a decision it was. His decisions are ranked from A to D. A is something that the committee were absolutely clear on, and so on, down to D, where it was only a, you know, the best sort of guess that they could make. Now, that's the way that today they evaluate and find out the text of the New Testament. It's not an entirely separate method from Westcott and Hort's, in that it does accept, by and large, the characterization of these manuscripts as being derived from a later revision. But it does evaluate the manuscripts, and in some important ways, it has moved the line back. If the Byzantine, that if theory one says, right, oh, the original is there, slap bang above the Byzantine text. If Westcott and Hort said, the original is here, right above the neutral text, then probably the you know, the text behind the NIV would put it somewhere like this. In several important respects, they've gone back to readings that are found in the Byzantine text, but still they're closer to Westcott and Hort than they are to the Byzantine text. To complete the picture, the sort of you know, the Trinitarian Bible Society Textus Receptus view would be over there. Now, what's we say? Let's call that NIV. You know what I mean by that, and that one's Westcott and Hort. It's interesting that I think, leaving aside those people, that's some from the Textus Receptus. There is a movement into the middle. And remember that we said at the beginning that the gap, the spread overall, is not major. And I believe that as things go on, as more and more manuscripts are found, that we will come back, you know, that gap will grow narrower. One interesting way of testing these, you see, end of last century, when Westcott and Hort made up their theory, those were the earliest manuscripts. Since then, those papyri have been found, some 200 years earlier than Westcott and Hort. Now, obviously, unless you've got a real rogue manuscript, the earlier you get, you would expect, however that family tree is filled in, that the gap is going to get narrower. And certainly the older the these old papyri that are found do give some sort of check. And it's interesting that several, in fact, probably they should be more on the thing like this. The papyri, I think, in most cases, tend to be that direction from Westcott and Hort. Some of the readings that Westcott and Hort rejected, because they said they were only found in these late manuscripts, sort of down here, they've been found in early manuscripts up there. So there's room for more evidence to be found. Who knows? We may find more manuscripts round about, you know, that sort of era. They'll cast more light on it. Okay. I put down some of the factors there. We discussed some of these last week. When you try to reach a verdict on this, you're faced with the claims of these booklets and individuals who get, drag you aside into the corner and give you a going over because you've got an NIV in your hand, or because you haven't got an NIV in it, whatever. There are many arguments that can be ruled out. When a jury, I've never been on a jury, but I understand that, you know, one of the tasks of a jury is to rule out things that are not relevant evidence. Arguments based on the godliness or ungodliness of the people behind various texts or translations are irrelevant. The AV writers may have been godly men. Westcott and Hort may have been ungodly men, but that is not relevant. Godly men sometimes make big mistakes, ungodly men sometimes get things right. And anyway, as I've shown you in the history, you know, many godly men, very godly men, Free Church of Scotland men, so they must have been godly, but were involved in the revised version of 1881, Patrick Fairbairn, David Brown, second to none in orthodoxy. So, you know, it's an irrelevant argument. You know, Einstein may have been a rotter, but his scientific work stands or falls on its own merits, not on the man's personal character. The jot and tittle argument we've heard sometimes, you know, how dare you leave out 1 John 5, verse 7. This, in fact, is the sort of argument that's used by these Textus Receptus boys, you know, that how dare you leave out 1 John 5, verse 7. Not one jot or one tittle of my word shall of the law shall pass away, says Jesus. But that's a silly argument, frankly. I mean, Revelation at the end says, cursed is anyone who takes away from this book. True. But it also says, cursed is anybody who adds to this book. And cursed is anybody who adds a jot or tittle to the law. So that doesn't, you know, that doesn't answer our problem, but it's an irrelevance. There's no scripture verse that is relevant to our quest here. There's nothing in the Bible that tells us that the Textus Receptus is the best. That's an irrelevant thing. Arguments from history, church and revival are not decisive. I watered that down. I was going to say are irrelevant. And I'd still be inclined to say that, but I was being moderate and I put are not decisive. See, some people say, look, this Textus Receptus, the Bible of the Reformers, look what blessing they had. Look, God used that Bible over the centuries. Therefore, it's got the seal of God on it. Now, my problem with that is that it's exactly the argument that the Roman Catholics used at the Reformation about the Vulgate. They said this has been the Bible of the Church for 1,000 years. Boniface and those other great missionaries, they went off to preach to the heathen with this Bible, the Latin Vulgate, in their hands. Therefore, it's got God's seal of approval on it. You can't argue that way. God blesses the church with revival despite the comparative errors of his people. George Whitfield was in the Church of England, after all. But I mean, seriously, we wouldn't say, would we? Look, George Whitfield was an Episcopalian. Therefore, God's seal of approval is on bishops. We wouldn't say that. It would be foolish to argue from any such thing that therefore something was authentic. It's interesting, Dean Bergen is the man who violently stood for this view that the majority text must be right, last century. And Dean Bergen's writings are the sort of Bible of the Trinitarian Bible Society people. Very interesting, Dean Bergen was not an evangelical. Dean Bergen was a high Anglican. That means that he viewed the church as the great thing. And I think Dean Bergen's problem was that he couldn't accept that the church had been wrong. If the church had used this version, then the church must be right. Now, as evangelical Protestant Christians, we wouldn't be happy with that. The church can be wrong. The church, through these Middle Ages, was badly wrong on vital doctrines. But it was Bergen's, I suspect it was Bergen's ecclesiology that made him so dogmatic there on that. The case is not yet closed. Both sides tend to use circular arguments. There's a great danger that people over here in these views will say, well, look, the Byzantine text is late, therefore we don't need to consider it. So every time you find a manuscript, even earlier one, that's got readings that look like a Byzantine reading, you say, well, look, it's Byzantine, so it's not very good. But that's a sort of circular argument. You've decided that it's not good. You've ruled it out. Both sides, you know, the argument that these things were not copied, there aren't lots of copies down there, therefore they must be bad, therefore we can reject them. Well, that's a sort of circular argument, or that's a question-begging argument. It's only a theory. It's not a proven thing. It's an idea. You know, you could say, well, you know, a mistake was made up here. But you tend to dismiss any reading there because it's a copy of a bad manuscript. Well, why is it a copy of a bad manuscript? Well, because there aren't many of them and you don't need to notice it. An awful lot of illogic is used there in the argument. It's a fact that the majority of evangelical scholars today accept the third's theory. Majorities are often wrong.